morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Matthew Miller from Cuneo, Gilbert & LaDuca, representing plaintiffs' appellants. It is not disputed that the background common law rule applicable to federal receiverships is that investors in entities placed into federal receiverships may sue derivatively on behalf of those entities after a receivership or a conservatorship has been implemented. There is about 70 years of common law, including two precedents from this court, the O'Connor and Davis Trust cases cited in our papers. The operative question is whether two statutory provisions in the particular statute governing the FHFA, the conservator at issue in this instance, changes that background rule. And it is not disputed that those provisions are derived ultimately from identical provisions in the Federal Deposit Insurance Act that were enacted in or around 1988 as part of the FIREA statute. The first of these two provisions at issue is a provision that provides that the conservator or receivership succeeds to all rights, titles, powers, and privileges of the regulated entity, of any stockholder, officer, or director, and so forth, of the entity.
Let me ask you, for purposes of this case, need we only decide whether at the time your client filed the motion he had any rights given the very broad language in the statute?
Well, the first question fundamentally is whether the ability to bring a derivative action is a right or a privilege or a title or a power at all.
Well, I'm thinking of what some of the other courts have discussed, both the Federal Circuit in the first Hartford case, the Branch case out of the district in Massachusetts. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, in first Hartford, the Federal Circuit recognized the well-settled principle established by at least two Supreme Court decisions that a shareholder derivative action is an equitable remedy. It's not a right at all that can be succeeded to.
In that case, the court, and it was a narrow holding, I understand, said that there is no remaining right absent evidence of a conflict of interest.
Well, we agree that the conservator succeeds to whatever legal rights a shareholder might have pertaining to the corporation. And the legal rights of a shareholder are somewhat limited. The principal one is the right to elect directors. And that right goes out the window when a trustee or receiver is appointed over the company. And that was true under 70 years of prior law. In fact, this court in O'Connor in 1936, long before FIREA was enacted, said that the controller of the currency succeeds to all powers and rights of shareholders. That was not something new in FIREA. FIREA didn't close out some loophole in previously existing law that allowed derivative actions to go forward.
But it also says powers and privileges. So even if you're correct about rights, it says powers and privileges also.
Well, there is no power or privilege to bring a derivative action. It's a standing doctrine pursuant to which a court sitting in equity may allow a shareholder or other equity holder in certain circumstances to bring claims that belong to the entity in which the investor owns equity. And the shareholder may implement that remedy even in circumstances where the shareholder has lost all of his legal rights, such as where a trust is involved. The ability to bring a derivative action is derived from beneficial ownership. It's not derived from any legal rights that a shareholder may have. And most importantly, in the receivership or trusteeship context, the shareholder has not alienated any of that equity. The shareholder continues to hold the same equity.
All right.
The FHFA.
As you've crafted the complaint here, are you suggesting that there could be these concurrent actions?
No. It's well settled under that 70 years of case law that the equity holder only has the ability to implement the derivative remedy where the party with the initial right to bring the claim elects not to act.
That's why I asked my first question. All right. In other words, say, hypothetically, 10 years from now, the conservator hasn't done anything. And maybe, as in the case before the Federal Circuit, it deemed, you know, a filing on the last day of the statute of limitations not to be enough to overcome sort of de facto refusal. Now, if that were the fact situation before the court, could it not be, given what some of the other courts have said, that the rights of your client might, quote, survive, close quote.
Well, really, the standard applied by this court, or the language used by this court in the O'Connor decision, is the investor can go forward if the controller of the currency has refused to bring suit. And other circuits have used analogous language. And the question is, at what point in time is it appropriate for a district court to make such a finding? You know, we would agree that upon the initial implementation of the conservatorship, the conservator was due some amount of time to make that assessment. But we'd respectfully submit that at this time it's had ample time to make that assessment. And it should be...
This court should de facto say it's refused to do anything.
We think at this point in time that would be appropriate. Alternatively, it could remand to the district court to make a finding as to whether.
Would it be under those circumstances only that your client's right would, as I put it, survive?
Well, again, it's not a right. Our client still has to jump through certain hoops to sue derivatively. Our client has to show that our clients have to show they've complied with the contemporaneous and continuing ownership requirements and that they are adequate representatives, as well as that the entity with the primary responsibility for bringing claims has not done so. And we would submit that at this point, given the passage of time, 3.5 years since the implementation of the conservatorship, the FHFA has as evidence from its conduct that it has refused to bring the suit.
All right. Do you want to save any time? We'll give you another minute.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Howard Kane for the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Your Honors, my good colleague, Mr. Miller, continues to want to rehearse the common law pre-FERIA, pre-HERA, the pertinent statute that authorized this new agency. Unfortunately for my colleague, the common law, to the extent he has accurately stated it, has been entirely superseded by federal statutory mandate. In their opening papers, that what they plead to the lower court in this court is, if the FHFA decides to prosecute the claims, we, derivative plaintiffs, will step back. We have no continuing role. But if they don't pursue it, it is our right. That position, Your Honors, runs right into the buzzsaw of the jurisdictional withdrawal. What they are looking to do is have this court look over the shoulder, second guess the decisions of the conservator. Congress could not have been more clear that it did not want this or any other court second-guessing the operational asset maximization decisions of the conservator. The conservator views these actions, would evaluate these actions like any other asset. What does the conservator believe the value of the asset to be? Does the conservator believe, taking into account all the relevant factors in pursuing litigation, that it would be appropriate to prosecute these claims based on the time, the expense, in the conservator view, the likely outcome, and results to the conservatorship? There is no even minor exception to that. The statute leaves no room for an officious intermeddler here, Your Honors. They want to, plaintiffs want to, appellant wants to second guess, have this honorable court second guess the conservator's decision whether or not to prosecute a particular action. Again, as I said, to do so would certainly affect, if not impede or prevent, the exercise of the conservator's discretion, the exercise of the powers granted exclusively to the conservator.
I understand you would like the court to write as broadly as possible, but my question to Mr. Miller as to you is, do we need to write that broadly?
Your Honor, for this court, for this case, what the court, in my humble opinion, needs only to state is that the case law is well developed since Faria and Hura, and the case law is that there is only a very narrow exception to the jurisdictional withdrawal, and that is...
It's not well developed in our circuit, is it?
No. Your Honor, well, in this circuit, there are decisions by former Judge Wald and others speaking about the broad withdrawal in the Faria context, which uses the same words. But the only exception that has been recognized, and only by two circuits, the Federal Circuit in First Hartford and the Ninth Circuit, I believe, in the Delta case, is that if a particular action would cause the United States to be required to evaluate an action against itself or against one of its agencies, such as in the Winstar context before the Federal Circuit, that might present an exception as recognized by a couple other circuits, but in no other category.
Do you agree with those decisions? Do you think they're right?
Your Honor, with all respect to the Federal and Ninth Circuits, I believe those decisions are going too far because the statute itself admits of no exceptions, but for purposes of today, it's certainly something this court need not address because nowhere has plaintiff ever argued that any conflict of interest exists with respect to the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
I noticed, by the way, that you cite this our unpublished order in Pirelli, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
How come you're not arguing that this issue is res judicata?
Your Honor, perhaps we should have. I actually filed personally on behalf of the FHFA the motion that this court granted in Pirelli, and it allowed the FHFA to withdraw the pending motion in that, excuse me, a motion for rehearing and rehearing en banc in that case, and perhaps we didn't do our...
Do you think it is res judicata? I mean, it's the same parties, same issue.
The issue is clearly the same, and I have, I don't want to be absolute because I don't want to miss one of the elements, but just thinking about it real quickly here, Your Honor, I see no reason why res judicata wouldn't apply on top of all of the other reasons presented in our papers as to why District Court Judge Leon got this case right and every other court other than the branch decision got this issue right, Your Honor. I see my time is up. Thank you.
I'll make four brief points if I can. First is a shareholder attempting to sue derivatively is always an officious intermeddler. That is the case when a corporation is managed by its board of directors who has the prerogative to bring claims. A shareholder cannot ordinarily assert the claims of a corporation in any context at any point in time in the history of American jurisprudence. Nothing changed that with Faria or Hura. And in fact, Congress, in enacting Faria, the specific language at issue here, said it was attempting to do nothing but to codify the powers previously enjoyed by receivers and conservatives of the FDIC and the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. Third, Mr. Kane makes reference to various case law, including the decision of the Fourth Circuit and Freddie Mac, an 11th Circuit decision. With all due respect to those courts, none of them addressed any of the merits arguments we've asserted here, namely that a derivative action is a remedy and not a right. They were simply reading the statute and reaching quick conclusions. There's no analysis in any of those decisions. It's incumbent upon this court to get it right, not merely to follow the pack. Lastly, with reference to the possible res judicata implications of Pirelli, I note that at most those could affect plaintiff appellant Kelmer and not plaintiff appellant Agnes, who is not party to those proceedings and who has asserted derivative claims that concern an entirely different set of facts in an entirely different time period. Thank you.
Thank you.
Issue 2, voluntary dismissal without prejudice. Mr. Kane for appellant FHFA, Mr. Clark for appellee Rains et al.
May it please the court, Howard Kane again for the Federal Housing Finance issue. On the issue on which we are the appellant, voluntary dismissal, we think that the, we believe that the district court made a single, but in this instance, glaring error of law. In the district court, after going through the various factors set out by this circuit in several cases, found in favor of the Federal Housing Finance Agency on a number of factors. It found that the agency was not acting in bad faith, that the agency had moved to dismiss without prejudice, in the court's words, well before the eve of trial. The court found that any work done by defendants could be used in any related litigation. The district court found even that the FHFA was, quote, sufficiently diligent in prosecuting the claims. But notwithstanding those determinations, the court, we believe, erroneously extended, and the word extend is the word of the lower court, the court extended the law of this circuit to rule and to make a ruling that was not suggested by any of the parties to the litigation, was not suggested in the briefings, but the court found that the fact that a motion to dismiss had been filed was sufficient to bar the Federal Housing Finance Agency the power, the authority, the right to dismiss this case without prejudice. The court found that notwithstanding a number of federal statutory provisions in which Congress attempted to empower the conservator with additional time, with adequate time, to evaluate the massive assets of an enterprise in conservatorship. And in this case, the court, as I mentioned, found that the conservator was acting timely, was acting promptly, but the mere fact of the motion to dismiss, the court found sufficient to extend the rule. But the rule, which doesn't even apply across the board, would require at least a summary judgment motion. What the courts and this circuit have looked at is how far along are the proceedings? How close are the proceedings to the time of trial? And the court, in all those instances, found that the proceedings weren't that close to trial. Everything was continuing. And to highlight the dispositive nature, in this case, of the motion to dismiss, the court need only look at Judge Leon's decision and to note that he did dismiss one case without prejudice, and that was the related Agnes, A-N-G-E-S case. And the only difference between the Agnes case and the cases which the judge refused to grant the dismissal without prejudice is that in the Agnes case, there was not pending a motion to dismiss. And that's the only factor that was different. Your Honors, I would like to save my last moment for reply.
I just have one question. Your alternative in the district court was to ask for 180 days, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, it's been 2 years now. Has the agency resolved this yet? I mean, do you care about this anymore?
Your Honor, I, with all respect, would personally have to say I am not personally involved in the evaluation of the claim, but what I would tell the court is my understanding is the agency still has this listed as a potential claim, a potential asset that would be analyzed if and when this court rules that there is still an action left to pursue. As far as any statute of limitations issues, we would believe that when the lower court judge dismissed without prejudice, that would allow the agency, if it did decide to proceed, to invoke equitable tolling. But that's not an issue facing this panel today. But, Your Honor, to my knowledge, this is still an active claim.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, Miles Clark on behalf of the individual appellees. Your Honors, the central issue in this appeal is the inherent authority the district court has in the efficient and just administration of its docket, particularly in derivative litigation and complicated multi-district litigation. The district court had before it two sets of motions in the two underlying derivative actions, Kelmer and Middleton. The first were dispositive motions, which had been pending for 2 years. They were fully briefed, argued, and ripe for decision. Those motions challenged the very ability of these particular shareholder plaintiffs to pursue claims derivatively on behalf of Fannie Mae. The motions were based in part on the preclusive nature of the prior litigation that had gone to judgment, the consolidated derivative litigation, which this court, the judgment of which this court affirmed in Pirelli. That judgment, that district court judgment, FHFA acquiesced in that judgment when it inserted itself into the Pirelli appeal for the purpose of terminating the appeal. The district court's granting of the dispositive motions would bring finality to the underlying litigation for both the court and the parties.
But haven't we held that that's not sufficient for to establish the legal prejudice the district court has to find in order to deny voluntary dismissal?
Well, the prejudice here, Your Honor, is...
What's the prejudice? I mean, you can always make this argument.
2 points, Your Honor.
This is the case. You don't lose the argument.
We don't lose the honor.
Right. So where's the legal prejudice?
The legal prejudice, Your Honor, is inherent in the nature of claim preclusion. These defendants have
already...
Well, you're assuming
you're right on claims preclusion. It's circular. I just don't see the legal prejudice here. I mean, I know, but... I see your point about the district court's authority here, but it's limited by our case law, and our case law seems pretty clear that there has to be, quote, legal prejudice, and the only legal prejudice the court identified here was the pending motion to dismiss. And I think we've said pretty clearly that's not enough.
Well, Your Honor, the motion, first of all, could have been, FHFA's argument is a bit of a form over substance. There is no bright line rule that it has to be a motion for summary judgment. However,
No, I agree with that. But here we have a motion to dismiss, which makes the case even weaker from your side because it's earlier in the proceedings.
Well, Your Honor, these proceedings had already proceeded to judgment, affirmed on appeal. This is the second round.
I still don't. Why don't you just, what's the legal prejudice? Tell me crisply, what is the legal prejudice? You do not lose the right to argue claims preclusion. That you have all that, you have that argument unaffected
Your Honor, the
by a voluntary dismissal, right?
The prejudice is the defendant's interest in finality and their right not to be sued on these very claims again. Uh-huh. Simply being hailed into court again on these claims is prejudice. Your Honor, the voluntary dismissal motions, the second set of motions, FHFA had presented no compelling justification for them, simply its assertion that it needed more time to consider whether or not it was going to bring the claims in the first instance. Granting those motions would postpone finality and place the defendants in an indefinite state of limbo facing these very serious and very public allegations that they had already litigated through judgment affirmed on appeal. FHFA was given an opportunity to present argument in response to the dispositive motions. They opted simply to rest on the papers that had already been filed by the shareholders. They presented no argument whatsoever that FHFA's substitution had any bearing on the outcome. In other words, they effectively told the district court they were ready for a decision on these motions that had been pending for 2 years. The conservator relies heavily on this court's decision in Conafe v. Wyeth Labs, the second Conafe decision, in arguing that the district court had abused its discretion. However, Conafe simply does not address the issues animating these appeals. It is distinguishable in at least three meaningful ways. First of all, Conafe did not involve a prior litigation between the very same parties that had gone to judgment. Two, the issue in Conafe was the submission of a summary judgment motion, a dispositive motion, after the plaintiffs had voluntarily moved to dismiss. The court expressly stated that if the motion for summary judgment had been pending beforehand, it would, the district court's reliance on that motion would have been understandable. Here, we don't simply have a motion that was pending. We have a dispositive motion that was fully briefed and ripe for decision. And third, the explanation given in Conifay. In Conifay, the plaintiffs early on in litigation had discovered information that they believed they had viable claims against the defendant, a potential defendant whose joinder would have destroyed diversity. So their explanation was they wanted to voluntarily dismiss so they could immediately go across the street to Superior Court and bring the case anew. Here, on the other hand, FHFA, their explanation is they need up to two additional years, simply to determine whether or not they were going to bring the case again in the federal district court.
Well, but we don't really have to think about that too much, I don't think, in view of the dispositive nature the district court gave to the pending motion to dismiss. I mean, if the district court was wrong about that, it doesn't really make any difference what we think about the reason the agency gave for the need for more time.
Well, Your Honor,
isn't that right?
I mean, highlighting the reasonableness of the district court's ordering of its rulings is the simple fact that FHFA presents no argument whatsoever that the district court got it wrong on the merits. It presented no argument.
Got it wrong on the merits of what?
Of claim preclusion. The finality
well,
of
but,
the case.
I mean, so your argument is that the district court didn't err here because there's no merit to the issue that the agency seeks to litigate. I mean, I don't think that's the way you look at this question.
Your Honor,
I'm sorry. I mean, you may be right about claim preclusion. In fact, it seems to me you probably are. But that's the issue they wanted time to evaluate the case.
Well, Your Honor,
to decide whether to take on that issue.
Your Honor, we believe they had sufficient time. They had the
No, but my point is we don't really have to think about that in view of, and this is just a question. I mean, if we think that the district court gave dispositive weight to the pendency of the motion to dismiss, then it really doesn't make any difference whether we think they could have resolved their concerns in one day or 6 months or 2.5 years.
Well, Your Honor, they had the amount of time that Congress gave them in HERA
circumstances. You're missing my question. What I'm saying to you, if we think that the district court erred by giving dispositive weight to the pendency of the motion, what difference does it make, even if we agree with you, on the weakness of their reason for wanting more time?
If the district court erred, Your Honor, you're correct.
Yeah, okay.
Thanks. Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may just respond to the legal prejudice point. My colleague on the other side did not, in fact, state what the lower court found to be the legal prejudice. The lower court found legal prejudice in that defendants have a reasonable expectation that when they file a motion that could resolve the case against them, whether that motion is for dismissal or summary judgment, the court will address it. Your Honor, there is nothing anywhere to suggest that the defeat of that type of expectation amounts to prejudice, much less legal prejudice. Indeed, Your Honor, in the case referenced by counsel, the Codafe case, this court said granting voluntary dismissal would mean that appellee would lose an opportunity for a favorable final disposition of the case. But that is not important as long as the appellee suffers no legal prejudice from dismissal. I don't know how that statement from this court can be read other than to reject the position advanced by the lower court and in plaintiff's papers, although not here today, that a reasonable expectation that a motion to dismiss will result in the end of the case constitutes legal prejudice. Your Honors, thank you.
Issue 3, dismissal without prejudice. Mr. Kane, Mr. Pellet, FHFA.
I'm going to address two issues with respect to the dismissal of the Kelmer action below. The first is the question of claim preclusion. And the second is, independently of that, whether or not the claim should have been dismissed with prejudice on the grounds of claim preclusion. Let me address the claim preclusion point first. One of the requirements of a claim being dismissed on this ground is that in the prior proceeding, the litigant had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the claim or the issue. And in this circumstance, Kelmer certainly did not have a full and fair opportunity to litigate the question of whether his litigation demand on the board of directors of Fannie Mae was wrongfully refused. As the record indicates, Mr. Kelmer was not given an opportunity by the district court to make that argument, and instead was placed, the district court placed the leadership of the case in the hands of plaintiffs who had argued that demand on the board would have been futile. That's an argument that Plaintiff Kelmer, in fact, had waived as a matter of Delaware corporate law. Once an investor makes demand on a board, they waive any argument that demand would be futile. And ultimately, the ground for dismissal by the district court of the shareholders' claims was that they had not satisfied the requirements of pleading futility of demand, something that Kelmer never even attempted to do in the first place. And that was also the ground for affirmance by this court of the district court.
At the time the district court granted this, dismissed the case, Kelmer was no longer a party, right?
Correct.
So why does he have standing to even argue this?
It is well settled that at the conclusion, you're talking about the action below, this action, that he was no longer a party at the time. And the answer is fairly simple.
He's been replaced by the agency, so.
Yeah.
And this action happened after that. So how was he injured by this?
It's well settled in this circuit as elsewhere that upon entry of judgment, all interlocutory orders made prior to judgment are merged into the judgment for purposes of appeal. I believe we cited a decision of this court on that point, and it's in accord with the decisions of every other circuit. We cited the IAM National Pension Fund decision from 1986.
Now, if we think the district court erred in the denying the voluntary dismissal, we don't even have to address this question right now, right? Why would we? In other words, if we say the district court erred, then why is this issue any longer ripe at this point?
Well, I think it becomes relevant if you conclude that the district court erred in substituting Mr. Kelmer out.
That wasn't the question I asked you.
I think it is relevant. I think there are two separate issues. One is whether the claims survive.
That answer is, that's responsive, I think, to my standing question.
But
my other question was, if we think the district court erred by denying voluntary dismissal of the case and we reverse and it goes back, then doesn't that restore the status quo prior to the time the district court granted this motion? And doesn't that leave the agency the right, if it wishes to challenge, to resist that motion?
I think that's correct. It would be correct with respect to the agency's ability, but it wouldn't address Mr. Kelmer's ability to sue derivatively. It would solve part of the problem, Your Honor.
Gotcha.
But it wouldn't solve the first problem, which is, you know, whether Kelmer is precluded by claim preclusion from going forward. I've reserved my remaining time for rebuttal, and in that time I'll address the second issue, which is whether the claim should have been dismissed with prejudice.
Thank you, Your Honors. Miles Clark again on behalf of the individual appellees. The district court correctly dismissed the Kelmer action on claim preclusion grounds. Mr. Kelmer did have a full and fair opportunity to litigate his theory in the prior litigation. He, in fact, did litigate that theory, presented arguments to the district court.
Do you think he has standing to make this argument here?
Your Honor, if he's properly substituted out, no.
Okay.
He did litigate his theory in the prior litigation. The district court rejected his arguments, and he failed to avail himself of the opportunity to appeal to this court. In January,
what was interesting to me is that My understanding in this court, if we consolidate cases, the parties still get to make all their arguments, but we treat it as a consolidated case. We hear it on the same day, et cetera. A little different, and I'm not clear what the rules are in the district court, but if you have complaint A and complaint B, the district court orders consolidation and then designates a lead counsel. If the plaintiff in complaint A doesn't agree with that theory, where is he?
Well, Your Honor, here the district court ordered the cases consolidated. Mr. Kelmer was listed as a plaintiff in the consolidated case. The district court appointed a representative, two representative institutional shareholders to fairly and adequately represent the interests of all shareholders. The court directed the filing of one consolidated complaint in the action. The district court rejected Mr. Kelmer's arguments that he should be able to pursue his claims separately. And if Mr. Kelmer had any issues with that decision at consolidation or the pretrial order or any other interlocutory order that merged into the final order, the judgment dismissing the case in May of 2007, he needed to raise those challenges at that point in time. His ability to do so expired long ago. In fact, when
so the refusal to allow him to add this count to the complaint, as it were, would have been a final appealable order?
It may have been, Your Honor. Another shareholder attempted to challenge the consolidation order and was denied the ability to appeal. If Mr. Kelmer was unable to at that time, it appears his argument is almost as if the consolidation order constituted an order dismissing his case. Then he may have attempted to appeal. He may have had jurisdiction, or he may have sought from the district court the right to appeal that. But at bottom, he certainly had the ability, when the district court entered the dismissal order in May 31st, to appeal. He simply did not. And in fact, within the time period he had to appeal, he filed his new case, which simply rehashed the claims that were subject to the dismissal order and were barred.
All right. Let's see, anything further?
I have nothing else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Even if this court were to conclude that the district court was correct in dismissing the claims on claim preclusion grounds, it still should have dismissed them without prejudice. The only issues ever addressed by the district court and by this court in the Pirelli appeal were questions of whether particular investors had standing to bring claims belonging to Fannie Mae on a derivative basis. They never addressed whether they had stated a claim otherwise. It all had to do with standing. None of that should bind the FHFA or another shareholder who might conceivably have standing from asserting the claims derivatively. But the current order of dismissal, as pointed out by the FHFA, ostensibly dismisses these claims on the merits. There's no basis for that when the only finding ever made by any court was that certain investors failed to comply with the requirements necessary to bring a claim derivatively. The claim should have been dismissed at most without prejudice.
Thank you. All right, I think that's it. Is that correct? Has everyone been heard? Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.